Media 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. The program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound. It can also be heard live streaming on WVOX.com all over the world. One can call into WVOX at 914-636-0110. But as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest this afternoon is author, Associate Professor Neil Maher, and our subject is FDR Civilian Conservation Corp, better known as the CCC, part of FDR's alphabet soup of the New Deal. It's about its enduring legacy and the roots of the American environmental movement. Welcome, Neil, to The Advocates.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, of course. Neil Maher is a associate professor in the Federated History Department at the New Jersey Institute of Technology and Rutgers University at Newark, where he teaches environmental history and political history. By the way, my daughter's a graduate of Rutgers University. I just want to mention that. Plug for her, and works for the Kennedy School at Harvard. He has published articles in academic journals, including the Western Historical Quarterly, Environmental History, and the Chronicle of Higher Education, and edited a collection of essays by historians, scientists, political analysts titled New Jersey's Environments, Past, Present, and Future. He has recently published Nature's New Deal. I'm holding it right here, the Civilian Conservation Corps and the Roots of the American Environmental Movement. It's published by Oxford University Press. It has won a Charles A. Weyerhaeuser Book Award for the best monograph in conservation history. He's currently researching and writing a book on the environmental history of the space race during the 1960s. You know, as I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on public policy issues. Public policy is therefore what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Over the years, the public policy of the United States has changed, been modified. On our show, The Advocates, this program is most often devoted to that subject. You know, the CCC became the most popular New Deal program amongst the general public, providing jobs for a total of 3 million young men and some young women, we'll talk about that, from families on relief. Implicitly, the CCC also led to an awareness and appreciation of the outdoors and the nation's natural resources, especially for city youth. Neil, with that in mind, what got you interested in writing about FDR CCC?
Well, there were sort of two experiences that got me interested. One was a personal experience, and one was sort of a more professional experience. When I was young, I grew up partly in Riverdale, New York, and when I was a young child, my father used to take my brother and I up to Bear Mountain State Park for, you know, weekend getaways or just even a day. And I got interested in looking at the landscape all around Bear Mountain and trying to figure out how it came to be. How did all the beautiful structures in Bear Mountain come to be? And then later on, when I was at New York University in their graduate program in history, in a research seminar, I decided to explore that. So I did a research paper on Bear Mountain State Park and realized that all the structures, a lot of the hiking trails, Perkins Memorial Tower, a lot of those visitor centers, were all built by the CCC during the 1930s. So it was a very nice coming together of my personal interest in a place and then also a professional interest in environmental history that sort of grew out of Bear Mountain. But then the book obviously became a national study for the whole nation.
Mm. And, you know, it's interesting about growing up in Riverdale. I went to Horace Mann at one time. Did you go to school in the area? Or did you go to local public schools?
I actually went to St. Gabriel's in Riverdale, and then we moved up the Hudson to a small town called Irvington.
Oh, yes.
And I went to Irvington Public Schools
very,
there.
Very good schools, yes. Yep. Not too far from where I live in the town of Greenberg, and very nice area. You know, today we take for granted the importance of the environmental movement, no question. Clean air, clean water, ecological interdependency is now, I would say, basically accepted and understood within all the elements of our political and social spectrum. But that wasn't always true, Neil. In your book, you describe the struggle over the establishment of the CCC. What was that struggle at that period of time?
Sure. Well, you know, in Franklin Roosevelt's experiences, he he brought together two quite distant, quite disparate and different sets of experiences that came together in his idea for the Corps. The first and most obvious was his experiences with the Progressive Era Conservation Movement. At the turn of the century, the early 1900s, many people were increasingly concerned about industry's wasteful use of natural resources, and they got together and they tried to promote the conservation of things like timber, soil, and water. And this conservation movement was very influential in Franklin Roosevelt's early life. Up at his estate in Hyde Park, he did a number of conservation efforts on his family's property. There was a soil erosion problem there, and he planted trees to try to stop that soil erosion. When he went on to the state Senate, he was very involved in helping to preserve the Adirondack Forest Reserve, and then also was on the Fish and Game Commission. And then when he became governor, he continued those conservation efforts. And then, of course, when he got to the White House, we have a whole host of New Deal conservation programs, from the CCC to the Soil Conservation Service to the TVA. But what is less well known is that Franklin Roosevelt also had early experiences with another organization that really influenced his idea for the Corps. He was very involved in the Boy Scouts, the Boy Scout movement of Greater New York. He was their chief scout citizen and ran the Boy Scouts in the New York area for years. He was instrumental in helping the Boy Scouts get camps up in upstate New York, where they could take thousands of young boys from New York City and bring them out during the summer into the countryside and rejuvenate those young boys and help them get healthy again. And it was that concern for what he later called human resources, these young boys, that joined up with his desire to conserve natural resources with conservation. And it's those two strands that came together to form the CCC. And he did this when he was governor. He began to take young boys, young Boy Scouts, and bring them up to Bear Mountain. And he created special scouting camps there that actually taught the young boys how to conserve natural resources. So even before the Corps was formed, he took the Boy Scouts and took conservation and brought the conservation of natural resources and the conservation of human resources together. Yeah. And that's what's new.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that, again, just to reflect on these two major schools of thought regarding conservation that came out of the CCC in the 30s. You know, with that in mind, as you've described it, what was the difference in actuality between the conservation movement before World War I and the environmentalist movement after World War II?
Sure. There's two things that are important to remember about the differences. One has to do with sort of the concerns of the movement, both movements, and one has to do with the component of both movements. The conservation movement during the Progressive Era, its concerns were quite narrow. Again, as I said, the concerns were, how do we use natural resources efficiently, timber, soil, and water? The composition of that movement was also quite narrow. It was led by elites, mostly wealthy businessmen, some foresters, and they were very much at the forefront of this thinking. It was not a grassroots movement. It didn't include working class people, for instance. So during the Progressive Era, it was a narrow movement concerned with a narrow set of issues. After World War II, we get this new thing called environmentalism, and it's quite different. First of all, its composition is much more broad-based. It's a much more broad-based movement, not just elites, but also joined by middle-class people and even more recently, working-class people. And the concerns are also broader. It wasn't just concerned with natural resources like timber, soil, and water, but it was also concerned with a whole host of more human-centered issues like ecological balance, the preservation of wilderness, and also health through outdoor recreation. So it's that broader set of concerns and that broader composition that I think Roosevelt and the CCC pushes us towards after the Great Depression.
You know, and getting back to FDR, many people here are familiar, obviously, with his early years also. You know, he inherited a large estate from his deceased father, James, in 1900, and he became quickly aware that the grounds of his property had been worked for almost 200 years. And
right.
and it was overworked, as we later found out, during the Dust Bowl and Depression. And
right.
he himself started to plant trees, I believe 20,000 per year and over 500,000 in his lifetime. And he considered his occupation as a tree grower. In fact, I think he wrote it, you mentioned that, in when he registered to vote and put what his occupation was. In this sense, didn't the farmers have to be educated? And part of that came out of the AAA, the AAA, and also the CCC had to look at situations that went beyond, you know, forestry, in a sense.
Yes. I mean, it's a very interesting story you bring up, that when he was taking over the estate from his mother, Sarah, he was 28 years old and read through family documents that his family had won corn-growing contests back in the 1840s. Mm. And he was very upset because his family was not growing very well. Not a lot of corn on the property anymore, but the property was suffering. And that's when he realized there was a soil erosion problem and began planting all those trees and listed his occupation as a tree grower.
Right.
But this other aspect you're bringing up is very important as well, is that the CCC is remembered most for being a tree planting program. But the work that the CCC did evolved over time, and that evolution is very important to how it resulted in changing our ideas of what conservation is. So it started with tree planting in the early 1930s, but in 1934, as you mentioned, the Dust Bowl hits in the Great Plains, and Franklin Roosevelt, being a very savvy politician, sends the CCC into that region to help farmers reorganize their farm landscapes. So they start planting their crops on the contour, which means around hills instead of going up and over them.
Right.
Taught them how to plant certain types of crops. It turns out he was also running against Alf Landon at the time, who was from Kansas, and it was a very good political move for him. But then in the later 30s, Roosevelt becomes concerned that many of these working-class Americans who've been unemployed for almost a decade in cities throughout America were becoming sort of unhealthy by a lack of work and a lack of recreation. So he begins to push the Corps into recreation development work, and they begin to develop over 800 new state parks throughout the country and also national parks.
You know, Neil, getting back to really, you know, before we move on other aspects, the core elements of the CCC, you know, there's three aspects of it. And how, you know, in describing the conservation work it undertook, there was three elements called the three horsemen. What were these three horsemen, and why were they so critical to be dealt with?
Well, I believe what you're referring to is they talked about three threats to the forests. There was one that was fire, and the Corps did a great job in battling fire throughout its career. There was another one that was disease and blight, and the Corps did things like fighting chestnut blight throughout the country by cutting down diseased trees and removing them. And right now, I'm actually having trouble remembering
insects.
The third one.
Insects.
Insects.
Right. Well, that's in
right.
the same
exactly.
ballpark
exactly.
as blight, I would gather.
Right.
You know, it's interesting, as you brought up about young men being involved in, you know, because of the effects of depression, many young men were actually unqualified by malnutrition for induction into the armed forces after we entered, you know, World War II in December of 1941. How did the CCC affect the physicality of the 3 million young men who enrolled in the program?
I would say if there was the most important way that the Corps changed the young men who enrolled, it was physically. And that physical change is also related to a change in these young men's thinking about nature, which we can discuss later. But many of them, as you said, came in horribly malnourished. They had to go through a physical examination to get into the Corps. Once they got in, they fed these young men enormous quantities of food, 3 meals a day. Many of these young men had not eaten 3 good meals a day in years. And on average, they gained over 15 pounds each during their time in the CCC. They were really very much aware of these physical transformations. They often commented about the muscles that they were growing as they worked outdoors in nature. And I argue in the book that many of these physical transformations actually changed the way they thought about conservation and nature.
Yeah, and they were part of it. You know, it's interesting that I'm talking to Neil Maher, author of Nature's New Deal, about the CCC and its incredible impact not only on our forests, on flood control, on fire control, but on the emerging environmental movement that really talks about the, you know, interdependency of nature with human beings, the importance of clean water and clean air, which are critical to our existence. You know, many of these young men you talked about came from all sections of rural and urban core. Most of these men were ages 18, 24, and never had worked. And now they're being trained and paid. How did this affect the young man's families?
Well, it was wonderful for the young men's families because, first of all, it was one less mouth to feed around the table, which was very important during the Great Depression. But secondly, the young men were paid $1 a day or about $30 a month, but 25 of those dollars each month went automatically back to the enrollee's family. So these families were getting some of the benefits, some of the financial benefits of their son being in the Corps. And there were numerous letters from mothers and fathers whose sons were in the Corps who praised Franklin Roosevelt and thanked him so much for helping them through the Great Depression with that CCC allotment.
And of course, they did a tremendous amount of work on the for the tourist industry, and that would evolve tremendously. I believe you cite that in 1933, there were literally 3 million people visiting national parks, and by almost the end of the CCC, 1941, 20 million people visited. What was some of the, how did attitudes change towards wilderness America out of the CCC?
Sure. Well, I mean, we talked about how the work of the Corps evolved over time from planting trees to stopping soil erosion to then developing parks. Those first two types of work, the tree planting and the soil erosion work, they were not that new. They hark back to the Progressive Era during the conservation movement when people were familiar with those types of work. But that new work, the recreation development work, to call that conservation as well was something different. So when the Corps went into these parks and began promoting what it was doing by developing visitor centers and hiking trails and museums in national parks and state parks, when it began to promote that, too, as conservation, people began to reassess, what is this thing we call conservation? Is it just the conservation of natural resources like timber, soil, and water, or is it also the conservation of humans through outdoor recreation? And it created a bit of a debate around these issues. And later on, some criticism of the CCC arises from some of this recreation work, and that expands this debate even further.
Mm. And, you know, it's interesting when you look back on the record of achievement. I mean, let's not forget, this is not digging holes and filling them. You know, this is not that. I believe, as you cite in the final 1942 report on the CCC, literally 2.5 billion trees were planted.
Exactly.
40 million acres of farmland were dealt with over the problem of erosion. 800 new state parks, 10,000 small reservoirs, 46,000 vehicular bridges, 13,000 miles of hiking trails. I mean, this is a legacy that has lasted to this day. You know, and this is so critical to our understanding of the beauty of America. And we all know that the national park system is very unique to America.
Absolutely. I mean, the area they transformed through their labor was larger than the state of California. Really just an amazing amount of work. And anyone who goes to a national park or a state park today, especially state parks, you are walking on trails and walking into visitor centers that were built by these young men in the 1930s. It's
right.
Wonderful.
You know, it's interesting at all of these camps, and there are hundreds of camps all over the United States, there were next to very small rural communities quite often. Could you describe the social, financial, and cultural effect the CCC camps had on these neighboring local communities?
Sure. Socially, when these camps first were located, when the camps were first sent out there, and they were all over the country in every state of the Union. When they first got there, the locals were very, very concerned. They envisioned the young enrollees as being urban ruffians who would go from the camp into town on the weekends, and they were worried about their daughters and these young men interacting. But quickly, that social concern was overtaken by an economic realization that these people in these local towns quickly understood that having a CCC camp nearby meant a spark to their local economy. And this is because, on average, about $5,000 a month was spent by each CCC camp on goods and services in the local town, you know, which comes to quite a bit of money over an entire year. We also have to remember that those young boys had $5 of that monthly dollar pay in their pocket each month.
And they had to spend it somewhere.
They spent it somewhere. So we have, on average, about $6,000 a month or over $70,000 a year per camp going into the local economy. So businessmen, local businessmen, very quickly embraced the CCC. And this, of course, again, helped Franklin Roosevelt to not only woo those urban working class people whose sons were in the Corps, but also those more rural businessmen who were benefiting economically from having a CCC camp nearby.
Yeah, and also this enabled many urban youth and young men who had never traveled to really see parts of the country they hadn't seen, interact with people that they had no commonality with it, with them, and also the local people to meet people, even a greater impact on them because they met hundreds of people from all over America.
Yeah, that's one of the most enjoyable things about writing a book like this is when you get to talk to the people who experienced this era. And I've spoken to a lot of former CCC enrollees, and they really think back on their time in the Corps almost the way that I think young people today think of their college experience. They're away from their family for the first time. They're somewhere different, a region of the country that's quite different, often very foreign to them. And they're interacting with their peers for the first time in a very unique way. And they just think of it as such a special moment, usually the defining moment in their life.
You know, it's interesting that when you think about the popularity of the CCC, and everybody says that this was one of the most, you know, popular programs. The AAA was popular. Henry Wallace was popular. Mm-hmm. The WPA, look at all the stadia that were built. I know Davis High School in Mount Vernon, we had a WPA stadium. And, the New Deal did things. It built things. And it's sort of a lesson for today that we're going to, you know, talk about later to see whether this parallel could happen today in a different form, because conditions obviously aren't exactly the same. Conditions never are. But talk a little bit about these 3 million men again being, and I believe you quoted the figure that 90% of these 3 million men served in World War II. So these were the fittest of our people. Is that so?
It's pretty amazing that percentage that went into the war. And that's even more surprising because when the Corps was first created, some of the few opponents, those who were in opposition to the Corps, did so on the grounds that they feared that the Corps would militarize these right. young men. There was a similar CCC-like program in Germany at the time, and people were very worried about fascist Germany and that these young men might become militarized. So the Corps went out of its way to limit the role of the Army in the Corps experience. So the Army ran the camps, but when the young men went out to do their work, they left the Army's responsibility and went under the Department of Agriculture, which is usually the Forest Service, or the Parks Department under the Department of the Interior.
We're coming up against a commercial break. I want to remind audience that they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 and live streaming on WVOX.com with Richard Garfunkel, my guest, professor and author Neil Mahar, and talking about FDR-CCC. When we come back after the break, I'm going to ask him the following question. How did the CCC affect the nation as a whole? We'll be back in a moment or so.
Matter where you go.
Driving in truck all day long?
Driving to work.
We're right there with you. WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lori London. Indictment unsealed. The Justice Department charges Najee Bouazizi and four other alleged members of Al-Qaeda in a plot to blow up New York subways last year, claiming it was directed by senior Al-Qaeda leaders in Pakistan. Officials say the Al-Qaeda conspiracy also targeted England. Well, he was like Osama bin Laden's right-hand man. Today he faced a military judge at Guantanamo Bay.
Ibrahim Al-Khozi entered a guilty plea to two counts conspiracy and providing material support to Al-Qaeda.
Fox's Catherine Herridge. He first met bin Laden in the Sudan.
And then he followed him to Pakistan and then on to Afghanistan. At times he was a driver. At other times he was a cook. And then ultimately he led a mortar crew after 9/11.
They're wilting in the Northeast.
Uncomfortable, just sweaty, and at some point just the breathe. Like I started having a little trouble breathing.
Extreme heat warnings continue up and down the East Coast. Fox News. We report, you decide.
Homeowners, how would you like to receive a $1,500 tax credit and save up to $465 a year on high energy bills?
Hella Windows wants to show you how for free.
It's time to replace those drafty, sticky, outdated windows.
Hella Windows makes window and door replacement easy every step of the way.
You'll enjoy informative, no-pressure shopping, free expert advice, and a free in-home consultation. Plus, we handle everything for you.
Save money on your utility bills. Make your home look beautiful. And get a $1,500 tax credit at the same time.
Call for a free, no-pressure, in-home consultation with a Pella Window expert.
Ask about the limited-time $100 off season special and 0% financing when you call. Call 800-483-8129. That's 800-483-8129. Experience the Pella difference for yourself. Call for your free consultation now. 800-483-8129. That's 800-483-8129.
At Entergy, meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
A lot of people sell office equipment, copy and fax machines. Some of the technology they're peddling is superb and some of it is not so stellar, I'm afraid. Thus, the dealer you buy from is just as important, you know, as the brand you select. Since 1972, the most respected, reliable dealer has been Vista Business Products. George and Bob Forstbauer's Vista, number one authorized Canon dealer in the tri-state area. They're the oldest and most established. So for the very best up-to-the-minute technology in copying, document management, rely on Vista, the newest technology from the oldest dealer. Westchester headquarters in Elmsford off 287 and 119. Call George or Bob Forstbauer, their sons George Jr., Bob Jr. There's even a daughter, Christine, in the family business. Vista Business Products and Canon.
Call 914-347-7888 or visit us on the web at www.vistacanon.com.
WVOX. Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. My guest is professor and author Neil Mahar, who has written a fascinating book about the CCC, one of the New Deal's most popular programs. Before the break, I asked Professor Mahar, pardon me, this question. How did the CCC affect the nation as a whole, Neil?
And I believe that we were talking about the various programs and then how people began to sort of debate the core. It affected in a number of ways. First, as we said, it created a sort of different way of thinking about the natural environment that I think, as we said before, led to environmentalism. But it also influenced New Deal politics, and maybe we could talk about that for a second.
Right, go ahead.
Basically, Franklin Roosevelt was a very savvy politician. He used this new brand of conservation, and he used the CCC to knit together this sort of liberal New Deal coalition that helped give rise to what we now call the modern welfare state. And he did it sort of three ways. He was very savvy regionally, so he put camps, he assigned camps to certain regions where he knew he needed support. For instance, the South, the Dust Bowl region, two regions he sort of picked out as places that if he put camps there, he would gain support. He also withheld camps from certain regions. If there were politicians in certain regions who were anti-New Dealers, He would withhold camps from their districts as a sort of a punishment to get them on board. So regionally, very, very savvy. He also was able to knit together the urban and the rural. And we've discussed this a little bit before with these urban workers, these urban working class people whose sons would go into the Corps. They were very supportive of the CCC, as were the local people near these camps in these rural areas that were financially gaining from a Corps camp nearby. So the urban and the rural he brought together. And then also he was able to bring together various classes of people. Again, working class people from urban areas and business people from these more rural regions that had a stake in this economy too, this new economy.
We have a caller. Go ahead and tell us who you are and what's your question, please.
It's Mr. Cam, and I don't have a question. Okay. I never have questions.
Oh, okay.
But I have contributions. I want to commend the speaker here for using the term working class. 60% of Americans are working class, more or less, as they are in other countries. And I think we ought to acknowledge their existence and the very different environment and problems that they have. So that's one thing that I've never heard before. And as a liberal Democrat, of course, we need more of that. But you mentioned something in passing there, something about only in America were national parks established. Actually, the Europeans were ahead of us on that in a different form. And I think it took in terms... the king had all these lands all over, let's say, England, for example, and people were not allowed to hunt, to cut down lumber, or use those resources in any way, and they had this sense of limitation because of the big populations. They could see the limits on what they were doing. We have never been able to see these limits. Reagan said we shouldn't think in terms of limits because Americans are strapping adolescents, and we should never think in terms of limits.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments on that, Mr. Cam. It's always nice to have you on. You know, Neil, in FDR's day, there were small government advocates, strict constitutional constructionists, labor leaders, business interests, especially logging, which was a large industry, and conservationists in the mold of John Muir. Were all these groups supportive of the CCC?
In the beginning, many people, many of these conservationists were supportive. Early on, John Muir and Gifford Pinchot, who was governor of Pennsylvania and one of the leading conservationists in the country during the Progressive Era, were actually friends. And people, other conservationists supported the Corps in those early years. John Muir was not around then. But as the CCC wore on and as the Great Depression wore on, there began to be some criticism of the Corps, and it arose on two different grounds. People like Aldo Leopold, who is a very, very well-known conservationist, he began to argue that the Corps, through some of its work, was actually upsetting ecological balance. He was in charge of some Corps work up in Wisconsin. He criticized things like the Corps planting single species of trees in straight rows in forests throughout the country. That was ecologically unsound. It should be a more diverse planting. He was critical of mosquito control through the draining of swamps. Those swamps are necessary for waterfowl migration. So you had an ecological critique that was very, very important in creating part of a national debate about what conservation is. But then you also had a second critique. And this came from the wilderness preservationists, and they were very much in that John Muir tradition. Bob Marshall, a very, very well-known wilderness advocate, went on to help found the Wilderness Society. He was involved in Corps work down in the Great Smoky Mountains, and he was very concerned that the Corps was building too much infrastructure in a lot of these national parks. And he was particularly concerned with road building, because the Corps built a lot of motor roads all over the country. And he went on to criticize the Corps for this road work, saying that that work was destroying the wild or wilderness character of a lot of our national parks.
But it was very good for firefighting. There's no doubt about that.
Exactly.
We have another caller. Go ahead, caller, and say hello.
Hello. How are you doing, Prospect? I'd like to know, how much did they make a month?
I believe our guest said a dollar a day.
And because now I was about 8 years old during the Depression, and my cousin was in the CCC. And the thing about it was the uniform he wore. And I think they had these hobnail boots that they used to wear. And he used to say that we make almost as much as the Army makes.
That's interesting. What was his impression of it?
Oh, he loved it. That's... Because, like you said, they used to travel, you know, when they got away from, you know, the city, because I lived in Queens.
Did he go in the service after that?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he went in 41. 41. And I used to tell people, and some don't believe me, I said, if the war hadn't broken out, the depression still probably would have been going on.
Well, there's much debate about that. There's no doubt about it. Thanks for the call. Thank you for your contribution. You know, Neil, in the 1930s, and we can't avoid the reality of this, there were many Jim Crow laws and traditions that existed inside and outside the South, both in the sense of de jure and de facto realities, by law or tradition or how people lived. What about the minorities in the CCC? Were the camps segregated?
It's not a great record. In the beginning, before they could create segregated camps, the camps were not segregated into black camps and white camps. They would have African Americans in some of these camps early on. Within those camps, though, they would be segregated in separate barracks. They would eat at separate tables. But as the 30s wore on, very quickly, actually, in the early 1930s, they had segregated camps. And what's interesting is that there were more complaints from local communities in the North when an African-American camp was located nearby than there were in the South. Mm. And I think that had to do with Southerners maybe being more familiar or more accustomed to having African Americans nearby. And in the North, there were people who were protesting the location of an all-black camp nearby. But then again, as the economics took hold and these local communities began to benefit economically, they sort of embraced these camps. But it was very tough for African Americans. I mean, they took a percentage of the population that was African American. They took that percentage and allowed them to join the Corps. But for those African Americans to rise up within the Corps to leadership positions, it was very, very difficult. There was a lot of discrimination still, and that was a sort of a tough story.
All right. Neil, we have to go to a short commercial break. I want to remind our audience that they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460. We're live streaming on WVOX. My guest is Neil Mahar. We're talking about CCC, Nature's New Deal and its impact on America. We'll be back in a minute or so. Thank you.
Is America's great community radio station.
Really seems to be in touch with the heartbeat of the city.
AM 1460 WVOX.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lillian Wu. The Justice Department unseals charges against five suspected al-Qaeda members in connection with the alleged plot against the New York City subway system. Officials saying the al-Qaeda conspiracy also targeted the UK, one key suspect.
Adnan Shukrijuma, among the top candidates to head al-Qaeda's external operations. In other words, he would be the man in charge of planning global attacks. He's been able to elude the FBI for years and still remains at large.
Fox Radio's Todd Starnes, meanwhile, a longtime associate of Osama bin Laden's, has entered a guilty plea at Gitmo. And the search is on for the abductor of a 4-year-old Missouri girl who was recovered last night. The possible suspect described as
a dark-complected white male, short dark hair, possibly in his early 30s.
St. Louis County Police Chief Tim Fitch. Fox News. We report. You decide.
New Jersey blueberries. They're fresh, great to eat, and they're here. Blueberries are a great source of vitamin A and C, and they're just 41 calories for a half cup serving. Besides all that, blueberries are delicious, and New Jersey blueberries are simply the best. New Jersey blueberries are juicy and sweet, great in pies, muffins, pancakes, yogurt, ice cream, or just by themselves. Let your imagination decide how to enjoy New Jersey blueberries. Remember, Jersey Fresh blueberries only come around once a year, and they don't last very long. So buy them and enjoy them now. You can even freeze them and enjoy them later. Go to your favorite supermarket and get some Jersey Fresh blueberries. It's a summer fruit treat that doesn't last very long, but they're so good. New Jersey blueberries, sweet, juicy, and delicious. Enjoy them now while they last. Courtesy of the New Jersey Blueberry Grower.
In the north end of New Rochelle, you'll find an absolutely top-notch printer, one of the very best in the entire county. Frank Maselli's Minuteman Press is known for its fine work far beyond the Sound Shore area. In fact, this particular Minuteman Press is easily the class of the fleet when it comes to full-service community printers. Located just off North Avenue in New Rochelle in the narrow Waikagill walkway across the parking lot from the A&P, Frank Maselli's Minuteman Press is a terrific resource for individuals and small to medium-sized companies who want something very special when it comes to printing. No matter how big or how small your needs, you get great skill and creativity from Maestro Maselli's master printers, all for very reasonable prices. From business cards to brochures, color copies, high-speed printing, informational booklets and flyers, it's Minuteman Press down that walkway when you're heading to the A&P, offering quality printing at very good prices. Call Frank Maselli at Minuteman Press of New Rochelle, 914-576-0335. 914-576-0335.
WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel and my guest professor and author Neil Maher, who has written a wonderful book about the New Deal CCC, how it shaped not only Americans' conservation and environmental concerns, but took almost 3 million American young men and rebuilt their depression-ravaged bodies and strengthened their confidence in themselves. Very critical because, as Neil points out in his book, 90% of these men went into World War II. They were in excellent shape. They understood regimentation. They understood how to take orders. They knew how to do jobs, and they became practically the core of our military. You know, our understanding of the CCC, Neil, was basically shaped by images of men working on reforestation, flood control, national park roads, bridges, and fire breaks. Were there women in the CCC, and what was Eleanor Roosevelt's role regarding women there?
From the very beginning, Eleanor implored Franklin to create a CCC for women or to allow women in the CCC and have female camps. He didn't do that for a number of reasons, the most important being that during this period, securing a job for the male breadwinner of a family was paramount in American culture. It would be very different today, obviously. But Eleanor was successful in creating one CCC camp that I know of for women, and it was in Bear Mountain State Park. It had a lot of women from New York City in it. Eleanor would go visit the camp a lot. She addressed the camp numerous times. But instead of putting the women to work conserving natural resources, these women didn't go out and plant trees or build visitor centers. They gave them skills. They taught them skills, domestic skills, so sewing and cooking and cleaning. And they taught these women these skills, and then actually they would go home and they could better take care of their families. So a very gendered division of labor in the core work that was going on.
Very prototypical of that era.
Exactly. That's just what I was going to say.
Right.
Exactly.
You know, we have another caller. Go ahead, caller. Tell us your name and what's on your mind.
This is Roy, caller from the Bronx. How
yes.
are you doing today?
Thank you. What's new?
Yeah, you seem to put a lot of stock in the New Deal. I know you're a big Roosevelt fan. I'm just wondering, I'm looking at the Department of Labor website, and according to them, 8 years into the New Deal, unemployment rate was 20.5%.
No, that's not true.
Department of Labor is lying.
Well, I don't know what you're reading, but and I don't want to debate it, but actually growth in the economy from 25% unemployment dropped by, I believe, 1940 to 10%. And if you took in the people who worked in the WPA and CCC and other areas, it would probably average about the same amount of unemployment in America that it did in Reagan's 8 years. Reagan averaged over 8.2% and had 10% two straight years, 3 years into his administration. So I understand. Do you have a question on the CCC offhand?
Well, but I've also looked at the New York Times website, and they also say the same thing, 20.5% unemployment. And according to, I believe his name was Bloomberg, was one of the architects of, was that his name, or Blumenthal or something like that? He said that they were trying to count people as working that were getting checks every month from the government.
Well, in other words, you're an opponent of the New Deal.
I just don't see how you can hold stock in something when all these websites, according to the New York Department of Labor, is not a political website.
I know. In other words,
it's 20.5% unemployment.
You're wrong. You're misreading the statistics. The unemployment and growth in the economy grew dramatically every year from 1933. In fact, under the understanding of what a depression or recession is about, the depression ended because growth increased in June or July of 1933. But I don't think you understand the length, breadth, and depth of the depression and understand how difficult it was to climb out of it, no matter what. And in fact,
the New York Times also wrong, because their website I'm reading right now says that what took us out of the depression was World War II.
So in other words, there wasn't enough spending. Is that what you're saying? That the World War II spending ended the depression?
I'm saying the unemployment, we were still in a depression after 8 years of the New Deal, and the unemployment was still over 20%.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your comments. You know,
can I respond to that a little bit?
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
No one is arguing that the New Deal succeeded in bringing us out of the Great Depression. That's not what any historian is arguing. We all know that it was World War II and the massive spending of World War II that brought us out of the Great Depression. What the New Deal did, and I think what our culture sometimes fails to do now, is it gave people hope and gave people a connection with the federal government that they hadn't had, and they knew that the federal government was trying to take care of them. And that, to me, was an amazing, important thing.
Well, it stopped the collapse that was happening. The country was in the midst of the collapse of March 4th, 1933. All the economic indicators had one of the greatest growth periods from 1933 till 1937 and 38, when pressures to close the spigot, stop the spending, caused the sharp recession of 1938. They turned the spigot on, and it was only an 8 month or 9 month recession on top of it. And we all learned the lesson that, as Henry Morgenthau said, with all the spending, we still didn't get out of it.
Yep.
That shows you the hole we're in. What about the hole today? We're in a hole today, and it doesn't seem the spending is getting out. We don't see jobs created by the private sector. So if the public sector didn't create jobs, you can imagine where we would be.
No, you were right. We should have spent more. That was the problem. Yeah.
I mean, I understand that there are people that forgot that the New Deal built the ability for our factories to become the arsenal of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to have forgotten that. They seem to have forgotten that it built these men that we've been discussing it to be the core of our next generation. They seem to have forgotten that this was all these things that were built in this country. Half the trees planted in the history of the United States were planted by the CCC. Should we have not done that?
I agree. I think we should keep doing it today.
Right. So this is, it's very interesting how 65 years later people, do this. Give us an idea. Obviously there were manpower needs for the armed forces became paramount as World War II emerged for ourselves. Did this doom the CCC, Neil?
Yeah, basically it did. I mean, World War II came along. A lot of the young men were leaving the Corps for the Army, so there were less people applying. The numbers were decreasing. They tried for a while to shift some of the Corps work to help for military preparedness. They had some Corps camps building, for instance, airplane runways. Some of them were put into the Pacific Northwest woods to look for fires. They felt the Japanese might try to firebomb the timber supply.
And they did. They were using balloon incendiaries.
But in general, there was just more concern and more funding going towards the military and the World War II than the Corps, and they terminated it by not funding it anymore.
You know, you've written a piece that I have in front of me called Green New Deal, and it's a, sort of a parallel today, and I think we should get into that. Can we bring back the CCC, or does it have to be in a different form? And you've articulated in this piece for your magazine article.
Yeah, I do not think that American culture would accept bringing back the old New Deal or even an old version of the CCC.
Right.
We've been basically rolling back the New Deal for the last 60 years in this country. I don't think Americans would embrace a program that was like the core originally. But I think that we can make the New Deal and the CCC and make it new and improved and do that through the market. And what there's one example I want to just mention, and that's Brazil. Brazil right now looked to the CCC, Franklin Roosevelt's CCC specifically, to put unemployed Brazilians to work planting trees in what they call their Atlantic Forest, which is up the eastern part of Brazil. They pay them money each day to plant trees, and instead of just having the federal government raise taxes to pay for that program, what they're doing is they are selling carbon vouchers that they receive from the planting of those trees on the international carbon market, and they're going to use those carbon vouchers and resell them and pay for the program through that market mechanism. Mm. And I think that we could do a similar thing with a new and improved CCC today. Instead of having young men, and in this case women, plant trees, we could have them plant windmills, energy windmills across the Great Plains in the former Dust Bowl. Mm. Or we could have them plant solar panels across the Sun Belt, or biofuels in the South.
You know, we only have a few seconds left, and I just want to make sure that we know what your next project is. Very quickly, Neil, what are you working on?
Sure. I'm looking at the space race during the 1960s and the 1970s, and I'm looking at the various ways that NASA, in a sense, used nature to promote the space program. Mm. And in doing that, they tended to also sort of co-opt some of the social movements of the 1960s, like the anti-Vietnam War movement, the civil rights movement, and the women's movement. Not consciously, but they just needed funding, they needed to be popular, and they used what they could to do it. So it's sort of an environmental history of the space race.
Great. Sounds interesting. Just a quick mention, so for audience out there, the CCC planted 2.3 billion trees, slowed erosion on 40 million acres, 800 state parks, 10,000 small reservoirs, 46,000 vehicular bridges, 13,000 miles of hiking trails, 1 million fish restocked in the American rivers. Not bad. Thank you, Neil, for coming on. You know,
thank you so much, Richard.
Yeah,
great.
Thanks a lot for joining me this afternoon, giving us a critical insight on how the New Deal and the CCC rebuilt our parks, saved our forests, and trained millions of boys how to become men. You know, next week, the Advocates will host financial and public policy advisor John Barreni, and we'll talk about his views on America, its sustainability, and its future. Yes, there are questions out there. Yes, there are people who are doubters, but we have to have this mixture of public-private enterprise to bring us out of what we're in. If you want to hear this program, learn more about my guests and their work, you can listen to this broadcast, The Advocates, and all others. They're archived on my website, advocates-wvox.com. It's a very hot day in Westchester. Stay cool and have a great afternoon. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.